It's going to talk on the synthesis of lanthanides on a nickel anode.
Foil in this example. He was placing the foil next to his X-ray tube, And if there are any neutrons produced, the foils will be activated. Then he was counting the foil, and he was using a Victorian Geiger counter, which is not a very sensitive device. And he was getting about 40 counts per minute. So this plot, according to him, is consistent with some initial activity on the silver right there that dies after 3 minutes, returns to the background. So I thought that was interesting, and I actually found his raw counts in his notebooks, and I plotted them. So the blue line is the count from activated foil, and the red line is the background. So now if you do the statistics, you have to compute the significance, you know, how statistically significant the difference between background and between activated silver counts are. And if you take just first, you know, 5 points from the activated silver plot, compare against background and compute the p-value, you get a statistically significant result of 5%. But if you add the 6 point here, the statistical significance disappears. So this only means that you don't have enough data points to run a statistical analysis. So the point I would like to raise, we all talk about measurements. Well, to me, a single measurement is meaningless. You know, 5 measurements are meaningless. You need to have a statistically significant sample when you are looking for small changes. So the rule of thumb is you need to have 20 to 30 samples to have enough to run your student t-test and compute statistical significance, and then, and only then, you may be able to tell whether your results are statistically significant or not. So this is clearly not statistically significant. Well, in his later work, Sternglass used indium foils, and indium takes longer to activate. The half-life is 54 minutes, so he was running for hours, but he used the same methodology. He used a Victorian Geiger counter, and this is his plot. Background counts before, you know, foil activated, and then counts from the activated foil that exhibit this nice, you know, exponential decay. Well, I'm not buying any of that, so I find his raw counts, and I plot them myself. So this is background before, this is counts from the activated foil, and this is counts from the background. Well, you know, without statistical analysis, it looks like, you know, there is something there, but, you know, you cannot really tell unless you run the student t-test and compute the p-value. So you plug the numbers and you get p-value of 23%, which basically says, you know, this is all a fluke, you know, this is not a statistically significant result. So Sternglass was a student at the time, so he was not a master experimentalist. He wasn't aware of proper statistical analysis techniques, so we can excuse him for not collecting enough samples, not, you know, computing the significance. But the bottom line is, you know, if you crunch the numbers on his raw data that's present in his notebooks, you know, he has no signal. So his conclusions are unwarranted. But, you know, undeterred, I decided to replicate his methodology just, you know, for shits and giggles. So I actually got a vintage counter like he had. I used an Americium beryllium source to millicuries to activate a silver foil. And then, you know, I counted the foil. And lo and behold, I got a plot that looked exactly like Sternglass's. You know, I had some activity in the first 3 minutes that, you know, quickly returned to baseline. But this is all just a random noise. This is what happens when you work with weak signals, with small samples. You can be really easily fooled by believing that you got a signal. So if I did collect more data, and of course I discovered that, you know, these bars go up and down, and, you know, this result really means nothing. You have to have at least 30 samples, you know, for the foil and 30 samples for the background, and then compute statistical significance. So this is just an illustration of how easily we can fool ourselves if we don't do proper statistical analysis. But undeterred by any of that, you know, I decided to proceed with the experiment and built a bunch of really, you know, high sensitivity neutron detectors. So this particular bank has 10 12-inch helium-3 tubes, each with 4 bars of helium-3. Very, very high sensitive, all enclosed in a Faraday cage to where, you know, no noise can penetrate and affect my counts. So I developed signal acquisition, you know, software that can, you know, discriminate pulse shape and do all sorts of statistical analysis. So, you know, this is state-of-the-art In addition, you know, I used secondary means of confirmation like bubble detectors by Bubble Tech and also foils. I was able to activate and count foils. So what did I get? So here is one result that looks particularly interesting, and I'm going to discuss it in some depth. So the red bars here correspond to neutron counts when the X-ray tube was on and the beam was striking the anode. And the anode in this particular example was nickel. So I tried a variety of anodes, copper, like Sternglass, and I went to nickel and titanium and some other alloys. So you can see that counts during the X-ray beam are really higher than the backgrounds. And I did run the statistical analysis, and you know, beyond any doubt, it tells me I got a real signal. But I got overexcited and I forgot to collect enough samples. I only have 30 samples here. So I cannot really pat myself on the back and say, you know, this is really a great result. But it was interesting, you know, nonetheless. So I proceeded to collect additional samples. And just to show you, you know, what stuff you're dealing with when collecting, you know, low signals is you turn the X-ray on, you got a bump in your counts. You turn it off, lower counts. Turn it on, higher counts. Turn it off, lower counts. So this looks very encouraging. So if you collect, you know, a few samples, that looks like you got something, but as you collect more and more, you realize, you know, nature is playing tricks on you. You know, this is not a real signal. So here is another example of experimenter's bias. So there is no way my background counts could be higher, you know, when the beam is off. You know, this has to be an error. Well, the truth is, you know, this is the nature of random processes, right? Your counts could be, you know, anything and everything. You know, you cannot discard them. So, and Sternglass, you know, did discard some counts and say, yeah, there's no way, you know, something's wrong with my setup. So the point is, you log your data faithfully, you don't discard anything, because this is all part of statistical analysis, otherwise you invalidate. So, what do I conclude from all of it? So I kind of revisited, you know, the data when you saw the this bar is rising. And I thought, you know, what if this was, you know, some transient effect? What if I focus on that and I research that more? So I reran the experiments and I was able to reproduce, you know, my higher counts during the X-ray, you know, heating, the electron beam heating the anode. So I thought, wow, you know, this is great. You know, I have a lot more than 30 samples now. You know, my statistics is good. It's significantly better than, you know, 5% level, and I tend to have it on this nickel and titanium anodes. So how great is that? So the point that I'm making here is, in the first, you look for the signal, you know. Second thing is you establish statistical significance of your signal. And then you start looking for systematic errors. So this is exactly, you know, what I did. So what I discovered, and that's the darn portion here, is that my counts were affected by systematic problems. For example, tubes tend to produce higher counts when they were just turned on. So tubes need time to warm up. And I didn't realize how bad that was. So okay, I figured that part out. I keep my tubes on under voltage all the time to where I'm not affected by that particular systematics. But I'm still getting, you know, higher counts when tube is on compared to when the tube is off. And when you run a statistical experiment, you know that the longer you run it, the better your confidence is if you get a real signal. So you can detect a real tiny signal if you accumulate more and more data. And that's what was happening in my case. You know, my significance was improving, and you know, p-value was approaching zero as I was collecting more samples. And I thought, well, let me try this thing. I will pretend I turned the X-ray tube on, but I wouldn't turn it on. And I will still record my data and see how it looks like. And I recorded some data like that, and Jesus Christ, it kept showing the signal. So I knew that, you know, some systematics was at play, so I really put the signal from the detectors under, you know, the magnifying glass, and I discovered that it had a small, you know, periodic noise. You know, you cannot really see, you know, 5 millivolts. But it was enough, and by sheer luck, the period matched the period of my measurements, and it was boosting, you know, the counts every other minute. So the point is, you know, I did not detect any neutrons that are statistically significant, but I learned a lot from this experience. But before I jump to that, and before I was going to throw this all away, I decided to look at the anode. You know, I said, okay, if I don't have any neutrons, what do I have on the anode? So So here you can see, you know, one of the first anodes that I used wasn't copper, it's stainless steel. So right there in the bright spot is where the electron beam was heating. And you can see those in black droplets that looked like they were expelled from the crater pit. So I figure, okay, I'm going to buy an electron microscope, I'm going to fix it, and I'm going to look, you know, at those spots. So here it's magnified, here's magnified some more, and here's an EDS map. In green are actually, believe it or not, so the reason I know it's thorium is because, you know, the ES spectrum shows all six of thorium peaks. You know, this is high confidence that this is thorium, and in those spots, thorium content is like 70%. And it's not like precisely calibrated, but I'm not talking a trace amount. So I don't know what to make of it, so I'm presenting it in the interest of, you know, being faithful to reporting, you know, all results that I get. I cannot exclude, you know, contamination. I do have thorium in my lab. You know, I have thorium wire and I have thoriated tungsten. I kind of doubt it made its way into the experiment, but I cannot exclude it. So encouraged by this, I started looking at all the other, you know, anodes I used. And the next one up is nickel anode, and that was particularly interesting because you could see how the color, you know, has changed in the anode pit. So that's where, you know, the beam was hit, and here you have this yellow spot. So I magnified it, I ran the EDS analysis, and I was shocked to discover that, you know, this area is almost entirely covered with, you know, lanthanum, cerium, praseodymium, all of the rare earth elements. And they were present in huge quantities, and by huge I mean they were dominant components. You cannot see nickel. So all you see is rare earth, you cannot see nickel. Well, I thought that was interesting, so I looked at the like virgin sample, and of course I couldn't see any lanthanides in the virgin part of the anode that was not treated by the electron beam. But, you know, I couldn't really feel happy, you know, something was nagging me, so I contacted the manufacturer and said, you know, what about, you know, this alloy? And they say, well, you know, we do have trace amounts of lanthanides to it, you know, to make it better. And this trace is under 0.1%, so you cannot resolve it in EDS in bulk. You know, no matter how hard you try, you're not going to spot that under EDS. But how come I was getting so much of it? And then it occurred to me, you know, when the electron beam hits, it hits the anode and it evaporates. So what is going to evaporate first? What melts first or boils first? So clearly nickel is going to evaporate first, and the lanthanides are not going to evaporate because the boiling and melting point is higher. So effectively what I was doing by shooting electrons at the nickel alloy, I was refining lanthanides. You know, I was evaporating nickel and whatever trace amounts of lanthanides that was there, it was getting larger, larger, and larger. And this is a repeatable result. So in one sense, I was successful. I can repeat this all the time, but I know it's not anomalous. So what are the conclusions from all of this? Well, you know, one thing I've learned that neither Stern glasses nor mine, for that matter, data, does not support an idea that neutrons are synthesized when you pass an electron beam through hydrogen atmosphere. So I think it's time to stop using, you know, Stern glass as results as a reference, you know, to support a nitrogen synthesis for whatever theory. But, you know, is this all really that bad? I don't think it is, because I want you to benefit from my experience. You know, I learned a lot in this process. You know, I think the main outcome is I developed a very, you know, high precision technique for neutron and gamma detection. And it's not just a technique, it's equipment that I'm making, you know, mostly for myself, but, you know, you're welcome to it. And I also gained expertise on SEM and EDS detection. So I call upon you to leverage my expertise, use my expertise in your project. So if you need something analyzed, if you need radiation measured, I think I can help you, because that's, you know, one thing I've been pounding on relentlessly for a few years. So before I step out, I just want to show you real quick some of the equipment that I'm making for myself mostly. This is a neutron detector in a Faraday enclosure. It was touch screen, and this is a bank of detectors. And I encourage you to stop by my poster presentation where I discuss in depth neutron detection. And what I was trying to accomplish here is to develop software that demystifies the process. You know, when you run a measurement, you don't really want to hit your head on the wall for days trying to interpret the data. So the software that I developed for these devices tells you whether or not you have a statistical significance in your results. And you can inspect and audit your signal so you can look for anomalies. And if your results, you know, pass the statistical analysis, you know, you can start looking for problems in your systematics. So I would like to end by saying that, you know, it takes incredible effort to do careful experimentation. So I've been doing, you know, the same thing over and over again, you know, for 3 years, and I think I'm really starting to learn about these processes. So what I really want you to take out of it is that we need to remain skeptical about what we're doing. And first and foremost, skeptical about our own results, even though, you know, we are believers in this thing. So the important thing is to never stop questioning, and especially our own results. So thank you.
We're slightly over time, but I've got one question.
Just a quick point. You've got all of that boron impregnated moderator or shielding. You've also got hydrogen. You could, with your sodium iodide, look for the 473 capture line on the boron and look for the 2.2 line on the hydrogen. So you've got actually now a very large neutron detector.
Yeah, I really appreciate that comment. So what I have is an experiment that I can keep doing. It's well instrumented, so if you all have any ideas of what else I can try, you know, what anodes or what modes of operation and what additional things to look for, I'm very receptive to that because I got that set up operational. So thanks again.